Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. It's 5 minutes past one. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Coghill, Representative Ramirez, Representative Dahlstrom, and Representative Gatto. We are delighted to have the committee assembled. This will be our only meeting this week. Today's agenda includes House Bill 9, which is the death penalty bill, House Bill 13, which is raising the threshold for property crimes, and then we have before us another bill, House Bill 101.
That's the easy one.
Yes.
That'd be an awfully easy one.
And so just to map out where we are for the week, and this week and next week and the following week. At Representative Gruenberg's request, it's okay. At Representative Gruenberg's request, we held HB 13 pending information from victims' rights and from police officers' associations, and we got back letters that raise enough concern that we will probably discuss on the record for a few minutes the subject matter and then set House Bill 13 aside and have some conversations with members on that subject. We will be taking public testimony on House Bill 9, the death penalty bill, today. And then we also will be setting that bill aside, and we will not take up the death penalty bill at all next week, as that is reserved for not only the House budget and to the extent to which it may encroach on House Judiciary Committee time, but also that all of next week will be reserved otherwise for parental consent of a minor to have an abortion. And then we will take up any remaining time next week with bills previously heard. And then the following week, then we will come back to House Bill 9, which is the death penalty bill. And anybody who's watching out there on gavel to gavel, please do not call our office for at least a week on jury nullification. The bill will be coming before the committee, but the incessant calling isn't helping us get through the work product that we have before us in the next 7 or 14 days. So for those that are especially passionate on that subject, you are doing our process a disservice. There will be ample time, and we welcome public participation. But if we could make any plea, this tends to be the same people calling all over and over, and the passion is appreciated, but not necessarily moving the ball either forward or backward. So with that, Representative Gruenberg, I'd like to have a brief discussion for no more than about 10 minutes, please, on House Bill 13, and discuss some of the items that came forward. And we've been joined by Representative Holmes, who we're delighted to have. And for those folks, Energy Council is very important to Alaska because it represents 90% of our budget. And as a result, many members of both the House and Senate will not be in the building and will be in D.C. advocating for the state of Alaska's needs and educating ourselves on how better to realize some of our goals and aspirations as it relates to energy policy. So with that, I'd like to bring House Bill 13 back before the committee for a brief discussion. Representative Gruenberg, at your request, and we thank you for it, We received letters from the Office of Victims' Rights, from the Alaska Peace Officers Association, and also from the Public Safety Employees Association. And all three of those entities were critical of our effort to raise property crimes. And I will ask members to review those letters and for us to have an informed discussion. There is a reason why we're called policymakers, and that is because we have to make tough policy decisions. This appears to be an emerging schism between those of us that are concerned that we're making too many felons out of young people and those that feel that we're not respecting the rights of victims who may not enjoy restitution and protection from people that are public nuisances and compromising our quiet enjoyment of our lives. Representative Grunberg, have you had an opportunity to review any of those letters? What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you and the other members of the committee, and you're all here, so I thank you all personally, for giving a little additional time for these other people to be heard. And I don't know if the department, I don't think the Department of Corrections, I know what the, were we also seeking, no, okay. But I just wanted to be sure that they had an opportunity to express their views. As I said last time, in the last iteration of this bill, the peace officers had opposed it, and I wanted to be sure they had heard, and I didn't know whether the victims had anything to be said. I understand my staff tells me that the Office of Victims' Rights has filed a letter dated February 27, directed to my office, which has been distributed to the members of the committee. And my staff, Allison, tells me that Mr. Kester does not plan to testify, and this wishes to have this letter inserted in the record in place of live testimony.
Yes.
I ask unanimous consent for that. The peace officers have submitted a statement by Rob Cox, and I don't know if Mr. Cox or nobody from their office is here. Are they available on the phone?
They are available on the phone. We have Mr. Cobb, Mr. Steiner, and Mr. Cox all available on the telephone.
I would ask that those who haven't testified, I believe Mr. Steiner did testify, if he wishes to add anything, fine, but the other people who haven't, I ask that they be given an opportunity to testify. And my interest was to be sure that everybody got a chance to be heard, and I appreciate your doing that.
Yeah, point made, and it has raised an interesting policy call for members of the Judiciary Committee. I'd like to hear briefly from the three folks that are online. This doesn't preclude us from bringing these folks back for a more dynamic exchange later, but I'd like to, they're available. I'd like to just get a couple of two or three minutes so that members can mull over some of their comments and remarks, and then we will come back to this bill as soon as our calendar opens up to allow us to, because it's...
I would make one request, that not close public testimony in case anybody has anything to add, but I'm not seeking to replow old ground.
Representative Kako.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Since it's the bill that I've introduced, I guess letting Representative Grunberg manage the whole process is something that troubles me a little bit. So, but I wouldn't object to what you're saying, but I would at least be asked to allow to be have some deference in the management.
Certainly, Representative Coghill. I assure you that the long hand of Representative Grunberg only reaches three-quarters of the way down the hallway. And the long hand of the rules chairman reaches all the way down the hallway.
And never let it be said I wouldn't defer to the rules.
Yes.
Or the chairman.
Yes, but point made nevertheless. Representative Grunberg, we thank you for your input, and it is appropriate pause for us to take to contemplate this interesting policy call that's before us, especially those of us that have a long track record of supporting law enforcement and the Office of Victims' Rights. It's an interesting decision. And then I'm very mindful of young people. We're making felons out of left and right and changing the trajectory of their lives. And it's interesting. Representative Coghill?
Just that, if I might, just have a minute to wrap up after you get that testimony. Just to, I'm not going to object to holding the bill over. In fact, at my suggestion. But there are some things that I would like you to think about as we come back to this discussion.
Absolutely. So with that, if we can just be brief.
Just help me manage it.
Gardner Cobb from the Anchorage Police Department, are you with us online?
I am. I'm here.
Hi, Mr. Cobb. Your thoughts, please.
I'm a captain with the Anchorage Police Department. The chief asked me to testify here today briefly on this bill. I oversee our detective division, and my thoughts in general is we do not support this bill on the grounds I don't think it serves our community well. I understand the major premise of this bill is to adjust for inflation, and one of the reasons is the concern that first-time offenders or young people might unnecessarily or too harshly get a felon on their record. But in my experience, 30-some years experience, not only here but in other states and law enforcement, the prosecutors in the system are usually pretty reasonable with first-time offenders and young people. Good example is what I happened up in service, you know, recently, last year. Most of the time, the prosecutors will take into account the circumstances, the nature of the crime, and the person's record. And a lot of times, these counts are consolidated, they're reduced, they get SIS, and sometimes they're dismissed with restitution. I'm more concerned on the other end of it when we have these career criminals out here wreaking havoc in our community. We just, a good example recently, and this is a burglary, not necessarily theft, but we arrested a person just the other day for 16 burglaries or more. And he had three counts of burglary, three convictions for burglary, and numerous other convictions on his record. I know from experience sometimes we have arrested people for fairly serious crimes that have had dozens and dozens of convictions. Typically, these people are involved in the drug world. They're career criminals. And my personal opinion, the opinion of the department, there is too much slack already in our system for these people, that they're causing damage to our community, and that this bill here is not going to do anything to address that. In fact, it goes in the opposite direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Officer Cobb. I see no questions around the table. We do thank you for your testimony. Can we go next to Quinlan Steiner, please?
Mr. Chairman, this is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender. I don't have any further testimony to provide. I was just making myself available for questions.
Thank you, Quinlan. We appreciate that, and we probably will take you up on that when we bring this bill back before us. And then finally, Rob Cox is with us from Public Safety Employee Association.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today on this bill. I'm in agreement with the Anchorage police officer representative. Much of the same points are made in my written testimony. You know, the question came to my mind, you know, what is it that this bill, passage of this bill, is hoped to accomplish? And it certainly doesn't make law enforcement more efficient or provide better effective or more effective protection for our communities. It just doesn't do any of those things. And really the only people that benefit from this bill, if it passes, are the criminals. And I think there's more to it than just the misdemeanor felony level and labeling youthful offenders as felons. If you look at the B misdemeanor, A misdemeanor threshold, that's increased by five times the current amount. And my fear is that passing this is going to create, we'll take petty thefts or shoplifting charges and transform them into potentially crippling financial losses to the victims with little or no consequence. I mean, as the Anchorage police officer testified, there's way too much leniency now in the system, and often B misdemeanors, which is what that $250 threshold would be, aren't even prosecuted, not because the courts or the prosecutors don't care, but the reality of their caseload is just overwhelming. So that often happens. There's plea agreements from the felony levels, and as far as youthful offenders are concerned, I think it's important for us to remember that felony charges don't carry that label. It's the felony conviction, and in light of plea agreements and those types of things. You know, I think the concern of labeling them as felons is greatly reduced. I agree, too, that really the only real rationale that I've heard or argument that I've heard for this, other than the youthful offender argument, is to basically inflation-proof this crime. And I just think that's a bad motivator for altering and passing a law. And again, the criminals are the ones that benefit from this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Any questions around the table, Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Rob, Carl Gatto here. Do you think that we might even consider going in the reverse direction to say, listen, doesn't matter if you're stealing $5 or $500, they all should be treated as stealing? Or you?
Go ahead. I guess that's really a policy call. Certainly, $250, $500 is still a significant amount of money to any of us. I dare say that none of us just go out and recklessly spend that kind of money. And at some point, there's got to be a threshold level for different levels of crime. $500 for the felony level, $50 from B to A misdemeanor has been on the books for, as some have pointed out, for 30 years. And I think they're justifiable at those threshold levels, even in today's economy, even with inflation, and particularly in today's economy on the downturn. It's still significant damage to somebody to lose that kind of a property or cash value.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cox, are you familiar with the Federal Youthful Offender Act?
We've done a little bit of research. Actually have not found anything federal in the U.S., but certainly found an act similar to what you're talking about that was passed in Canada.
It's been a while since I did any federal criminal law. My recollection is there is something, and I thought it was called the Federal Youthful Offender Act, or you could get sentenced as a youthful offender if you're under 26, and it provides for more lenient sentencing in certain cases if there's no record and a good chance at rehabilitation. Does that ring a bell with you?
Not in the U.S. I mean, the only thing we were able to find, which follows right along the lines of what you're talking about, was the only thing we could find was in Canada.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions based on the testimony. The first is I'm looking at theft in the second degree, which is a Class C felony under existing law, and it looks like there's already a provision in that statute that if you are a repeat offender, that on your third offense it's bumped up to a felony. And so I just wanted to, given that we were having this discussion about time and again and again and again, it looks to me like that provision is already covered in our existing law, that basically third strike moves you up to a felony anyway. Is that your understanding?
Is that a question for me?
If you'd care to answer it.
Yes, that is my understanding.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. The other just comment I had is I know that the actual legal ramifications for being convicted of a felony obviously only become relevant upon conviction, but I think that there are a lot of things in everyday life, job applications, et cetera, school applications, things like that. Don't some of them ask whether or not you've been charged with a felony, not just whether you've been convicted? Isn't that something that you'd have to report going forward, even if it was pled down?
I haven't filled out a job application in years, and I don't know whether it asks.
We're glad of that.
I don't know if it asks if you've been charged. I know that there are questions on nearly every application of import. Have you been convicted of a felon or a felony? When you get into adult life, I mean, all of that, if it's a youthful offender, when they hit 18, that all goes away and they get a fresh start anyway. So how they answer those questions at that point, I'm not sure what actually controls that, and I'm not sure about the felony charge question.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying. We're just struggling here, trying to figure out the right policy call. So just trying to flesh out the different aspects. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. We appreciate your point of view today, and we will revisit this issue. Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for those who testified. that's really some of the questions we need to get down to. Mm-hmm. First of all, if you think my motive is to inflation-proof crime, that is a misunderstanding of what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to figure out what is a real felon and what is a misdemeanor. I really, truly am trying to dig down to that. The idea that the court system has a huge amount of discretion, the prosecutors have a huge amount of discretion, and there's already slack in the system, makes me wonder if we're just using this felon charge so that we can get custody of people and then have to go through the negotiation process. And to me, what that does is beg the question, do we ever go after a misdemeanor? Are property crimes a real issue to the people in your district or mine? And so I'm going to keep pushing the issue. I understand some of the technical issues about the Council on Domestic Violence have brought forward. The letter just landed on my desk this morning, so that's why I'm going to ask the chairman to hold it over, and I will take a good hard look at it. But the policy call is not to ask how can we bargain justice, but what is real justice? And then when we get down to it, then you folks get to handle it as a policy issue before prosecutors and the judges. So, but what it appears to me is the fact of charging people with felons is already an SIS issue. The fact that you get to charge them and you engage the whole system then becomes almost a de facto suspension of imposition of sentence type of thing. You're hanging over somebody's head and then trying to get them to agree to a justice that is now a bargain rather than a fact. So that's what I'm trying to drill down to. It's not to try to inflation-proof crime, and it's not to let criminals get away with more property crime. It's really to get down to the question, is a misdemeanor ever worth going after on your resources, and do we have this felon crime hanging over people when it's not appropriate in other areas of the law? So that's my pitch at this point, Mr. Chairman, and I will take these comments and try to come back to the committee with a further discussion that drills down even deeper.
Thank you. And I will remind you, as the prime sponsor, Representative Coghill, that I remain a co-sponsor on this bill. And we'll continue to work with you through these complex issues and until we reach a resolution that is satisfactory for young people, for the Office of Victims' Rights, and for other folks, I thought through the testimony from Officer Cobb and Officer Cox of a tactful way to say this, and I haven't quite yet figured it out. But speaking on behalf of homeowners and business owners across the state, they're often dissatisfied with the level of attention that is paid to the property crime presently. So as law enforcement articulates how concerned they are about the existing statute, it would be nice to balance that against a strategy from law enforcement to execute sufficient sensitivity to homeowners and business owners and individuals that are suffering from precisely this property crime. It's clearly not working. If you polled 100 homeowners and 100 business owners whether the status quo is working well, I doubt that you'd get a glowing response. And so the issue warrants revisiting, and I applaud the prime sponsor for taking on the issue, and I think we're all mindful at this table that we tend to just turn the screw one way, which is to tighten, and I think that this is a very complex issue and an important policy discussion for us all to have. So I look forward to having that discussion as we've had time to digest this correspondence and revisit any public testimony. And then have a very vibrant discussion on this subject, which I've said from the outset, in many ways, is far more relevant than the testimony we're going to take today on House Bill 9, because House Bill 13 actually affects the lives of everyday Alaskans, and I'm mindful of drawing that distinction and have done so when asked in committee and with the press. When we juxtapose these two bills, one is a great philosophical issue, and the other one is really a very practical matter of of law and the function of the legislature. So with that, unless there are any other final remarks, I think we will set House Bill 13 aside. We will return to House Bill 9.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
Just to ask, I have a staff member here with another, I think it's House Bill 101. Are you going to get that up for just a record today?
Yes.
Or should I dismiss her?
Yes.
Okay. After we do this? Okay, yeah. Thank you. I just, if she was going to be here and not get to, I was going to put her back to work. Thank you.
Who is it? Is it a good one, Coghill?
Yes.
Amanda, we like you. Yes. We're gonna force you to sit through our whole committee, and we will reserve some time and Representative Grunberg.
I'm going to have to absent myself for a few minutes. No disrespect, but I must be somewhere.
Yes,
and
sir.
I'll be back.
Okay. So with that, we are going to take up House Bill 9. We have some testimony here in the room, and then we will see what kind of public testimony we have available. We are not closing public testimony today. I know that we have had some fatigue with folks that have been calling in and waiting on the line. We're not closing public testimony today. We do have four folks here in the room. Vicki Audi is here. Vicki, it's a privilege to have you before our committee. We're glad you're in town. If you'll introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, it's really an honor to have you here.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
A little closer is better.
How about that?
Perfect.
Okay. My name is Vicki Audi, and I am here wearing two hats. I serve as the executive director for the ANCSA Regional Association, which is the association made up of the regional Native corporation presidents and CEOs. I also am here as the chairman of my village corporation, where I have been serving for 25 years, and that's in McGrath. So I live in Anchorage, but my heart and my home are in rural Alaska. Since 1970, there have been 130 prisoners in the United States on death row who were found to be wrongly convicted. Once a prisoner is executed, we can never undo it. As an Alaska Native person, I must loudly object to House Bill 9. Alaska Natives will be disproportionately affected by this proposed change in sentencing. In 2007, Alaska's population was 70% white and 15% Alaska Native. However, our prison population is 48% white and 36% Alaska Native. Native people represent over twice the prison population as they do the free population of Alaska. It is very likely this proposed death penalty will affect my people twice as much. I have personally experienced seeing Alaska Native people take plea bargains just to get it over with, even when they were not guilty. Many of my people, particularly in rural Alaska, cannot afford representation as others who may have the financial means to do so. Clinton Duffy, former warden of San Quentin, has made the following statement I find very telling. The death penalty is the privilege of the poor. Court systems all over this country, no matter how well intentioned, make mistakes. We cannot afford to make a mistake with someone's life. All studies done on the death penalty and the cost to maintain death row prison populations show it more expensive to execute a prisoner than to imprison them for life. Why are we considering implementing something so barbaric at a time when the state cannot afford it? If you want to spend that kind of money, I challenge you to find ways to spend it on programs to keep our young people away from a life of crime, such as providing more money on workforce development. There are more compelling reasons, but my last argument is that my husband, who has spent 36 years in law enforcement in this state, has seen horrific examples of what one human can do to another. If anyone should be in favor of a death penalty, one would think he would be. He is not. In fact, most of the law enforcement officers that I've had the opportunity to know in Alaska are adamantly opposed to implementing the death penalty. If vengeance is your goal, isn't life in prison a greater suffering for the inmate than death? Lastly, every legislator on this committee should go home tonight and look at themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, do you want to be personally responsible for the death of another? Do we as Alaskans want to lower ourselves to the level of a killer? Would you take on the job of being the one to push the button to end one's life? My assumption that your answer would be no. Please don't pass this bill out. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Audi? Representative Lynn?
Is this a racial problem or is it a problem of poor folks?
It's a problem of our population in the prison system is overrepresented by Alaska Natives, and people who cannot afford legal representation would be the ones that would suffer the most.
And what I mean was, are they there because they didn't have the money to get adequate representation, or there because of being a Native?
I don't know why they're there.
I don't know either. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Audi. We appreciate you taking the time to come before the committee. Next is Charles Campbell, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Charles Campbell. I live here in Juneau. I served as Director of Corrections for Alaska during Jay Hammond's administration. I've been involved in various roles in the fields of corrections and criminal justice for quite a long time. I don't hope to offer testimony as eloquent as that which you've just heard, however. I oppose House Bill 9. Indeed, I have opposed all death penalty restoration proposals since coming to Alaska 30 years ago. Correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe it's been about 10 years since this body considered death penalty legislation. I do know it was about 10 years ago when former Senator Robin Taylor, long time the legislature's most vociferous death penalty advocate, he told me that he had come over to my side, that he no longer supported capital punishment. His main concern was about the matter of wrongful convictions, which was getting some attention in the media at about that time. I suspect that the undeniable truths that he had been hearing at gatherings such as this, year after year, session after session, had some effect as well. Given all the circumstances, I'm frankly astonished that we are once here talking about reinstituting the death penalty. It is true that Alaskans pride themselves on being different and not much inclined to be influenced by what people think or do elsewhere.
Thank you.
But I'm pretty sure you agree with me that it's not a good idea to ignore the experience and the tough lessons learned elsewhere. If you've been following the news, you've learned that quite a few jurisdictions across the country these days, for fiscal purposes, are looking at ways to discontinue all death penalty prosecutions and legislation to repeal death penalty statutes are under serious consideration in 7 states, and repeal is likely in 3 of those states. It has become quite obvious that the death penalty is the most problematic and useless of all criminal justice sanctions, and extremely expensive. I haven't been here for much of the previous testimony on this bill, but my guess is that all has been said that needs to be said about such matters as the inordinate cost, the lack of the value of death penalty as a deterrent, the outrageous capriciousness and lack of fairness in application of the death penalty. I do want to emphasize this one unequivocal truth. The death penalty is destructive to the families of murder victims. I'll say that again. The death penalty is destructive to the families of murder victims. You'll recall that in 1972, the Supreme Court struck down use of the death penalty throughout the country. Then, after 4 years, came the Gregg versus Georgia decision. that restored the constitutionality of capitalist punishment, but with very stringent requirements. And so now we have these long years of appeals, almost never less than 6 or 7 years as often as not longer, much longer than that. The families of murder victims can't get on with their grieving properly, can't bring closure to the terrible tragedy they've experienced. The circumstances tend to encourage ongoing bitterness and frustration and unhappiness for years. It's so much better when the matter can be settled in a year or two, as in the case here in Alaska, and in other states enlightened enough to not have the death penalty. A 99-year sentence with appeals exhausted within a year or 2 years is very useful in bringing closure. I urge you to listen to the pleas and the advice of quite a good few folks who have come here before you in this matter and lay this ill-considered death penalty idea aside once and for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Campbell, Commissioner Campbell. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I guess I have three questions. The first is, do you believe we ever have closure if you've lost a person of your family?
Probably not.
Okay. The second question is...
But we come closer to having closure when...
I understand.
...when we know that the punishment has been administered.
It's cost. If indeed you did a study and other people did a study and they all agreed that the cost of execution was less than the cost of lifetime incarceration, would you change your mind?
I certainly would not.
Okay. Then
I'll tell you how that goes.
I've
been in the field of corrections for 60 years, or at least involved with it, but I have been opposed to the death penalty for much longer than that. My Baptist preacher, Dad, in Virginia, during the time that Bruno Hauptmann was on death row, made it clear to me that the death penalty was wrong, so I would certainly not. I'm convinced by the evidence, but I also happen to have strong moral beliefs about it.
Okay, so I'm really just trying to address your testimony.
Yes, right.
And gentlemen, if you could just direct your remarks through the chair, just so we remember protocol.
Continue, Mr. Chair. The last question I have is with regard to certainty. If indeed we could be certain that we'd not executed someone wrongly, would you then change your decision?
No, I'm opposed to the death penalty, so that would I should.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Commissioner, it's a pleasure, and you live here in Juneau, and I would encourage you, when there is an issue before this committee with which you have a strong point of view, it's a pleasure to have you here. It's an honor to have you here. Please, we need more wisdom in this building, whether we're on the same side of this issue or not. I respect you enormously, and you're always welcome in our committee room. We would enjoy having your point of view on other matters as they become before the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chairman.
Sir. Thank you. Reverend Solides, what a privilege to have you before our committee. Should have had you offer a special invocation as we began, but I was worried you might lose your notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've made the decision not to have any notes in front of me, so I can't speak to a different issue. My name is the Reverend George Solides, and I'm rector of Holy Trinity Episcopal Church here in Juneau. And the two witnesses that have already spoken have addressed a large portion of what I had to say, but I do want to make some reference that the Episcopal Church as a denomination is on record since 1958, again in 1979, and again in 1991. As being against the death penalty, and I want to represent that to this commission, to this committee, and that the members of the Episcopal Church in large in this state are very much opposed to the death penalty. I want to speak to, maybe more specifically, as the former vicar of St. Stephen's in Fort Yukon, Alaska, and as regional missioner from along the Yukon drainage from Eagle to Stephen's Village, it was my privilege to live and work among the people who, in many cases, did not have the kind of VPSOs or trooper presence that might have been helpful in many kinds of criminal cases. I cannot believe, in fact, I find it impossible to imagine that this state, lacking the resources it already has to do a proper job of investigating lesser crimes, has at its disposal the resources needed to properly investigate capital crimes to the extent that we're willing to execute someone, as has already been said, an irrevocable decision that cannot be undone with further enlightenment and investigation and evidence come to light. I also want to note also that I've actually had 12 years of contact with San Quentin Prison as a priest in the Diocese of California and residing in San Francisco. It was my unfortunate privilege and honor to visit that prison regularly as part of a renewal ministry to the inmates there, and also to stand vigil outside the gate of San Quentin at every execution. That occurred during my tenure there. The emotions are exactly represented in me just this moment, as is evident outside the gates of that prison amongst the constituents on both sides of the issue every single time it becomes necessary to carry forward the law of that state and execute a citizen. It has been said that this is a helpful conversation for this committee and for this state to have, this bill and its debate. Perhaps. The vitriol in which that conversation continues, however, once a law is passed, is beyond the understanding of any of those who have not witnessed it. It deeply rends the social fabric of every state, and it's particularly every community that has to be the locale of a death house whenever an execution takes place. Those that cannot come present lob bombs at each other through email and internet and sound bites on television, and it does nothing to enhance the quality of life for the rest of the citizens of the state as they go through the process of each and every time an individual is being executed, debating whether this is the person this time who should properly be executed, or whether perhaps we might be able to convince someone of an extenuating circumstances that prevents us from having to take responsibility for ending another human life. I very much urge you not to move forward to a time when this state will undergo that same kind of agony each and every time an execution comes forward. And I think that concludes the bulk of my remarks. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Reverend Slidish, you know you enjoy enormous respect with members assembled here and the members of our body. You're a great man, and you offer great wisdom to many of our preceding many of our floor sessions, and thank you. If I could ask you a question, how is it when you're offering counsel and comfort to families that are the victims of an atrocity by someone known, unknown, imprisoned, or otherwise? Could you articulate a little bit of that, just so that at least on the record we have, you know, both sides of the coin? I'm not in any way diminishing the testimony that you offered, but to be fair, could you talk a little bit about how it is when you have to counsel a family who has lost a loved one who is the victim of an atrocity?
Well, unfortunately, I can speak from personal experience, here in Alaska in particular. First of all, I want to make the note and agree with what's already been said, that there is no final comfort provided by myself, most especially, and not for days and months forward. However, some comfort can be given when one meets the person in their pain and acknowledges it and says that the crime is heinous and the pain is beyond measure. And the moral depravity of the person who may have moral depravity of the person that committed the crime is not the question. The question is the moral strength, fabric, and ongoing life of the person who is suffering, the one who's lost. What kind of life do they want to live going forward? And that isn't heard sometimes immediately, but it does seem to take seed that is planted, does seem to come to fruition later, that they do not want to in any way become the person who committed the crime. So it takes a deep relating to a person to be able to say what follows from that. So I can't give you there is no generic answer to the question other than most of the time the answer lies at the who they are and who they wish to become. And the journey is going to be through terrible pain in any case. But I guess my counsel has always been, do you want to be responsible for the rest of your life? Should you ever come to a clarity of mind and peace about the death, to have it infected by being responsible for further injury?
Thank you, Reverend. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's just say you had a certain job, and your job was to counsel only this specific group of people. And all of the people in this group were people who had been killed by a convicted murderer who was on death row, but through a technicality, was released. So now we have this second pool of victims, and you're going to counsel them. Are you able even to counsel that group, or would they, what would you tell them? Yes, I know we let this guy out. We know he can kill your loved ones. How do you counsel that group?
Here's the if, Master. Just to have a brief moment.
The responsibility of every injury is always responsibility of the perpetrator, always. It is not, the crime is in the person who does the killing. And there, whether they, you know, the person escaped or got off on a technicality or continued to injure when we had the means to stop them, the actual criminal behavior is theirs, not those that might have had any. I would counsel them and you that the social fabric is ours to preserve, regardless of those that seek to destroy it. And that remains a continuing imperative. And to be realistic, I couldn't counsel those people. You describe a situation that I think is beyond my reach, at least. But I would make that attempt in the way I've just described, if it made any sense.
You did. Thank you, Reverend Slides. Representative Cockrell?
Thank you. And we could do a lot of what-ifs here. But I think the most compelling part of your testimony is what happens publicly and to the social discussion when somebody is, in fact, executed. So I appreciate that. One of the things that I try to keep separate is how you, as a pastoral counseling, would help somebody who has been a victim of a horrible, horrible crime, loss of life, and how they might deal with it, over against how we as a state might see it as one who would have an authority that, from my understanding, bear the sword and hold people ultimately accountable. But even from my study, at the end of that particular issue, the individual is still given a spiritual counsel and at the last said, "May God have mercy on your soul." So there is another reckoning, I think, that I think you and I might agree with. But what we're struggling with is how might a state value the life of victims who, here's the list that I said, who were basically innocent, didn't have the basic human right recognition, had no mercy, had no appeal, had nobody there to defend them or to liberate their defense, time to change, or anybody to counsel them. And so I think there
the confidence in our system is what really then it comes down to. Do we really have a system that can hold people accountable? And as we're going through that, we'll be looking at it. But I think one of the more salient parts of your council is, should we even get there? What would be the social discussion afterwards? And so I appreciate that part of the testimony, and I just wanted to make sure that he understood that.
Point made.
Reverend. Thank you, sir.
Reverend, quite a privilege to have you before a committee. You're always welcome, and we thank you very much for your sensitive thoughts.
Thank you, sir. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, we are going to invite up Mr. McKinley Sr. We're happy to have you. Yes, sir. We are going to begin to limit testimony to 3 minutes. At approximately 2:30, we are going to go to John Novak with the department.
I got my sea monster to eat every one of you.
You what?
So, sir, we're gonna limit your remarks to about 3 minutes, and then I'm gonna ask you to seat over the microphone since we enjoyed your testimony last Wednesday.
Okay.
All right. Are we agreed? About three
okay,
minutes.
Okay. I'll go as fast as I can.
But we agree 3 minutes. Is that right?
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify on House Bill number 9, Capital Apartment. My name is Alfred McKinley, Senior, resident in June, Alaska. I'm an executive committee member of Grand Cap Alaska Native Brotherhood, a delegate to Central Council of Tiquette Highlands Indians of Alaska, and I serve on the Judiciary Committee, served in the United States Armed Forces, December 21, 1950 to December 20, 1957. During the Territory era, our people were discriminated against. That's one of the reasons why our Alaska Natives and other citizens voted to abolish capital punishment. It's no different today. Our Alaska Natives are being discriminated against. Only the minority will be affected. For example, Alaska Natives receive longer sentences, and we have nobody to defend ourselves. There are no police officers in the rural villages to maintain peace or control on drugs and alcohol being shipped to rural communities that prohibit the aforementioned. I visited with Frank C. White, who I grew up with in Huna, Alaska. Frank served the United States Marine Force Recon Outfit. Frank retired as chief police officer and also a leader of the Eagle Wolf Clan. This is what my wife recorded during our visit on February 28, 2009. Recording, visitation, Frank White Sr., we will be getting some information on death penalty during the territorial days of why this was discontinued. When the minority is coming out of a bar, police arrested him right in public. A legislature saw this was happening and wanted to prove this action was misdemeanor. So he went downtown and waited until the police were present and watching the bar. He then came out of the bar and urinated right on the side of the sidewalk and then on the police car. The legislature was a white man that wanted to do away with this misdemeanor. The cops arrested anybody that stunk. That's the same way when a guy killed someone that was not determined whether it was premeditated. A premeditated murder is to kill is automatic death penalty because he planned on it. This happens spontaneously. It dropped down to a second degree, third degree, fourth degree. Anytime a minority kills someone, it was automatic premeditated. Whether it happened in the bar fight or elsewhere, if the guy died in the fight, the guy had it because he is a minority. So it shows right there that a minority gets the death penalty. It was not determined that it was a first degree, second degree, third degree, fourth degree, whatever.
Mr. McKinley, the 3 minutes is expired. Would you please summarize your remarks?
Yes, it's well, it shows here that when a young girl was actually adopted in Admiralty Island, Mr. Chairman, that they took her to Admiralty Island Biden. They killed her there, and the warriors went over there and killed the all the miners. So these warriors went to Skagway, where the penitentiary was, and they executed those warriors because they did not know what the white man law was.
Okay.
And for this reason, Mr. Chairman, that our people, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, of the testimony, we oppose capital punishment because of the above reference. And that concludes my testimony, but I had several questions. And I read your bill, and I don't like Chapter 58, Capital Punishment, page 13, where it states Attorney General election to seek death penalty. In my opinion, it's political. The Attorney General is appointed position. And the other question I have for the Chairman was Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in the bill, is this Alaska Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court? And that's what I was confused on, what it was. So as far as it was that discrimination, okay. It was racial. That's the reason why our people don't like capital punishment. That concludes my testimony. Any questions I'll answer.
Thank you, Mr. McKinley. On your second point, Representative Holmes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the references are to the Alaska Supreme Court.
Is this Alaska Supreme
Alaska,
Court?
Not the U.S. The references in the bill, I believe, are to the Alaska Supreme Court. Okay. Hope that helps.
Mr. McKinley, thank you very much for coming before our committee a second time and for offering your testimony. We appreciate that. Here in the room, we have Albert Judkin. Albert, if you'll come before us. It is for those listening, and I know we're getting fatigued with some of those that are online. If you have a seat, sir, we're happy to have you. At approximately 2:30, the committee is going to go to Mr. Novak. Mr. Novak is with the Department of Law, and we've been waiting to hear his testimony on the bill for some time, and then at 2:45 we will take up House Bill 101 and take an overview of House Bill 101. And we have a considerable list of people that wish to testify online. This is the last person we have that is before us in the room today, I believe. Sir, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, we're happy to have you, and we'll try and limit your testimony to three minutes, please.
My name is Albert Judson. I'm representing myself. I'm diametrically opposed to the death penalty in no uncertain terms. I'm from Haines, Alaska. I'm a registered voter. My box number is 1151. There are some things I believe that should be reflected on House Bill 9. The people on death row need to be considered. And I'm reading from a report by the ACLU of April 9th, 2007. It's the most current report. Out of 3,350 people on death row, over 40% of them are African American. A disproportionate number of Native Americans, Latinos, Asians, mentally disabled, and poor people make up this number. The word capital punishment is ironic. Only those that have capital don't get punished. It's not a deterrent. States that have the death penalty do not have lower crime rates or murder rates. It also reflects further on the disparity of race, and even more because of the way that the capital punishment is carried out. It's like going past go and don't collect $500. It's a rush to judgment, and there is no judgment. Everything is assumed because you're a minority. Since 1973, 123 people in 25 states were found not guilty. Out of those 123, 23 spent most of their life in prison, in death row. They were innocent. 25 were executed. And 25 more were found not guilty because of the DNA facts. In 1970, 55 were killed, and 20 between 1980 and 85. I use the word killed because we don't know, I don't know, no one knows how many of those were innocent. And also, if you take a look at Alaska and the high crime rate, you take a look at Native people within these borders and the disproportionate number of Native people that are already in prison. And once they're in, no matter what that charge is, they become part of the woodwork. And that reflects on the simple fact that they lack effective defense counsel. The public defender agency is not as effective as private attorneys and people that have the money to pay for them.
If you could wind up your testimony for us, please.
Anyway, I feel that these things should be considered in House Bill 9. They shouldn't be ignored. I think they should be discussed by this committee before they go any further.
Thank you for your testimony. You. We appreciate that. Any questions? Representative Lynn?
Yeah, same question I asked the previous person testifying. Is the reason for this problem, is it racial? Is it poverty, or is it something else? Why the situation is as you describe it? What's the reason for this? Racial or poverty or something else?
I'm sorry.
He can't understand it.
Okay.
Well, excuse me for not saying it more plainly.
I believe it's a combination of things. For one thing, when I have discussions with some Native leaders, I believe that the biggest negative impact on Native people has not been the military or any other factor. The biggest negative impact was the dollar bill, because it destroyed our system of bartering. It destroyed our economic sustainability. It made us go back to square one, and we ended up with a minus economically. That's one thing. And also, it's a historical fact that over in Germany, that pockets of poverty were created by the Nazis for Jewish people. So if that is possible over there, it's possible over here. I'm not saying that it's being done, but I'm saying that it's possible.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right, we will go offline to Fairbanks, to Monty Shade. Monty, are you with us?
I am. My name is Monty Shade, a continuous resident of Fairbanks for the 40 years. And yes, I am absolutely for the death penalty. And as a white person, favor the execution of as many white candidates as will qualify for that penalty. I have never viewed it as a punishment, but as a deterrent only. Do deterrents work? Of course they do. As an example, in Europe, as Soviet forces advanced in the final months of the Great Patriotic War towards Berlin, those Soviet troops found facing Moscow were executed immediately. There were few desertions. In Europe, by 30 January 45, over 40,000 U.S. soldiers had deserted their fellow comrades, and the 28th Infantry was ordered to execute Private Eddie Slovak as a deterrent to the crime of desertion. Desertions which came to an abrupt end almost overnight after his execution. USA, 1 March 1932, the 20-month-old son of Anne and Charles Lindbergh kidnapped from family home, Hopewell, New Jersey, then murdered. Convicted, Bruno Hauptmann was executed for that crime. Kidnappings ended and didn't resurface until after the Second World War. 1949, we have so many, When we look back, we find names like Martha Beck and Ray Fernandez executed for the murder of 17 innocent young women. I remember, too, the crimes of the Boston Strangler, Gary Gilmore, John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy. But on 13 June, 83, with a pickaxe and driving it into the living bodies of innocent Jerry Lynn Dean and Deborah Thornton 40 times, Carla Faye Tucker drove deep the weapon and was put to death 3 February, 98, as a deterrent to others on chemicals and drugs. By the way, Cuba has a death rate of 0.02 per 100,000 residents, Turkey 0.04 per 100,000, Saudi Arabia 0.04, and countless other death penalty nations have no problem at all with murder. In fact, the U.S. is 16 times greater in per capita murder rate of those nations. Why is that? Well, these three and so many other nations make an example of the condemned. They do not hide an execution. They display and widely publicize it. The publicity, openness, and means of execution slows the murder rate to a crawl. Life sentences mean nothing as a deterrent in those countries. By the way, the EU, European Union, spends tens of millions of dollars through U.S. organizations to fight against or abolish the death penalty in the U.S., while even now, many EU member governments are attempting to bring it back as crime, murder, and terrorism surfaces again. And I have this down to 3 minutes. Alaska, too, is an extremely murderous state, and due to the two-minute attention span of so many residents, I must bring to their memory the horrific slaughter and dismemberment of a multitude of Native women on Chena Hot Springs Road. Also, the killing spree from Fairbanks to Manly Hot Springs, the murder of a state police officer, and a number of others by an animal named Silva in Manly Hot Springs. The Baby Doris Erring Badger Road killings by an Air Force NCO, and then also the 7 or 8 murders in Bethel. And who can forget the baker from Anchorage that hunted down dozens of women as if they were nothing but insects and then slaughtered them? The one example, though, kept so quiet in the North and so typical of an Alaska serial crime, though not in Alaska, 58 innocent women raped, tortured, murdered, and dismembered, then fed to his hogs, which he butchered and sold to dozens of Alaskans traveling through British Columbia to Alaska.
Mr. Shea, can you wind up your testimony, please?
Okay. I was going to get into the drug cartel in Mexico, but it's okay. Everybody's been reading about it. I thank you so much. I'll wrap it up right now. I thank you all from the bottom of my heart. God bless you all, and God bless and protect the state and the innocent people of Alaska. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shade. Questions for Mr. Shade? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. We have in the room Mr. Betts. Mr. Betts, will you come forward, give us your name, and we're trying to limit testimony to 3 minutes, please.
Thank you. My name is Jim Betts. Thank you, Mr. Chair and esteemed committee members. My name is Jim Betts. I'm a resident of Alaska, a Catholic, a Knight of Columbus, in an organization of over 1.8 million men with 1,800 members in Alaska. As the advocate for the Alaska State Council and the Knights of Columbus, I wish to have my feelings known and those of this great organization heard today. Together with the Knights of Columbus, I am opposed to the passage of House Bill No. 9. Perhaps it is good that Representatives Chenault and Ramirez have brought this forward House bill imposing the death penalty for certain offenses in the state of Alaska. Through this process, the people of Alaska will hear the voice again in an overwhelming response to reject the capital punishment, imposition of death penalty by lethal injection. Let's bury only one item in this procedure today. Let's bury this bill and not another body. There's been only one death to save the lives of others, that I can recall, and Jesus is definitely here among us today. House Bill 9 must be defeated. It should not leave the House of Judicial Financial Committee hearing rooms. Remember that we are an evolving creation, and we as humans are mandated to improve and not diminish our human condition. The idea that we might deprive another human life of, as quid pro quo, an eye for an eye, is an old and untenable cliche. The idea that the death penalty is a deterrent, we are not convinced. We must not live in a culture of death. We are here to create, we are not here to create another wrong. If we execute one other person who may be innocent. We have alternatives. Life imprisonment without possibility of parole speaks volumes to the journey we've made from crude logic, barbarism, and brutality. So let us evolve our actions. Let us set the bar of human response above these base animal instinct to leave the cruelty and the nihilists and move to a world where we turn our cheeks to knee-jerk punishment reactions. Now is the time to be heard, unabashed, certain and resolved that life in any form is to be cherished. Life is precious from the womb to the tomb, and as such we turn away from the culture of death and create instead a culture of life. Death and death alone will be the time for final reckoning, and all humans will reconcile with God. That judgment is his and his alone.
Thank you, Mr. Betts. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was really surprised to hear you use the word knee-jerk reaction, because that's not my question. Here is my question, though. What's the reason why we incarcerate or execute people?
To restrict their access to the general population.
Thank you.
Human.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Betts? Mr. Betts, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, sir. Can we go to Mike Smith? And Mike, are you?
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Smith, and I'm an Athabascan Indian, and I'm also a tribal member of the Native Village of Nulato. But I'm here today on behalf of the Tanna Chiefs Conference. As you're all aware, Tanna Chiefs Conference is a regional nonprofit here in Fairbanks composed of the 42 communities and tribes in the interior portion of Alaska. The tribes in this region have had, historically, have had a well-documented and concern about racial disparities in the Alaska justice system experienced by Alaska Natives. Matter of fact, we have a standing resolution from our delegates on this issue. The statistics are clear that Alaska Natives have higher rates of conviction and receive more onerous sentencing than any other racial group in Alaska. The result is that Alaska Natives, who comprise, and some of this information you've heard already, but we'll reiterate it here, comprise roughly 15 to 18% of the population, comprise roughly 36% of the correctional inmates. In territorial days, the largest number of convicted murderers were white. However, the largest group of people executed for murder were minorities and Natives. To my understanding, it's our understanding, of the 8 people executed under civil authority in the Alaska Territory, 2 were white and the rest were minorities. The important issue raised by the death penalty is not whether or not people favor or oppose the death penalty, but rather the critical issue is whether or not the death penalty and who will be executed under the death penalty. The well-documented imposition of the death penalty upon innocent people is an obvious concern, but of equal concern is the disproportionate imposition of the death penalty upon racial minorities. The importance of race as a factor in the imposition of capital punishment is well-documented. For example, under federal law, the death penalty may be imposed for certain drug trafficking crimes. The General Accounting Office has documented that 75% of those convicted under these laws were white, but 89% of those executed under the statutes are racial minorities. Racial inequality is injected into the justice system at various points of discretion exercised by police, prosecutors, judges, and juries. At each of these points of discretion, decisions are dominated by non-Native people. That discretion in Alaska and elsewhere in this nation disfavors racial minorities and acts against their best interests, certainly. attended Chiefs Conference has long been concerned about the disparate treatment of Native people by the Alaska justice system. These concerns were recently highlighted by the racially charged Hartman murder trial here in Fairbanks, in which some people feel state prosecutors used racial arguments and circumstantial evidence to obtain the wrongful conviction of four young Native men in front of predominantly white juries. Questions have been raised about the failure of the police to make serious inquiries about white persons of interest in this murder case. The Hartman murder trial has raised serious concerns on the basic fairness of Alaska justice system toward Alaska Natives, and once again reaffirms the longstanding concern of the TCC delegates and TCC itself about such inequalities.
Mr. Smith, can you summarize your remarks, please?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Before addressing the justice of a death penalty, Alaska needs to address the inequities of Alaska's criminal justice system. Unless Alaska addresses these issues, the question to this committee is not whether Alaska should have a death penalty, but rather whether it is proper to execute minorities in disproportionate numbers to their population. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are there questions for Mr. Smith at the table? Representative Lynn?
Thank you for testifying, sir. Is your argument against this bill primarily a racial argument?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, our concern about this is actually the disproportionate penalties imposed upon minorities, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, I appreciate your remarks. It's troubling for me. You know, I was raised colorblind. We just elected a Democrat president who I voted against because I don't often vote for Democrats in presidential elections. I didn't pay any attention to the fact that he's an African American, and it is difficult to chair this meeting and hear, as we did last week, the word mentally retarded used over and over to describe a group of people with certain disabilities, and it is difficult to hear about Alaska's past over the last 50 years and injustices done to minorities, and to hear that there is such a broad belief that those injustices will be projected into Alaska's future. And I just want to be on the record as saying I'm more optimistic about our future than the record of our past. And I'm mindful of those statistics, but I look forward to a 21st generation that will be a much more colorblind society, both the justice system and the system around this table. So I appreciate the quality of the dialogue and what people are saying and the questions that are being asked by the members of this committee. Any other questions for Mr. Smith? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. Can we go next to Deborah Bloom, please, in Willow?
Yes, thank you. I, first of all, would like to say that I'm really heartened to see that there are only two representatives, Chenault and Ross, who are willing to put their name on this. Thank you to all the rest of you who did not.
You're welcome. Could you introduce yourself for the record, though, please, Deborah?
Beg your pardon?
Could you just introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Deborah Bloom. I live in Willow, Alaska. I also have had family members who have been murdered. I also was a rape victim. I was raped in my own home. So I don't just speak as, you know, someone on the street. I speak as someone who has had these issues close to home, literally. That being said, I am absolutely against the death penalty. I am also very familiar with the criminal justice system in Alaska. And until we can say we have perfect prosecutions, we have no need for appeals courts, and that there are no innocent people who are found later, you know, after they've been convicted to be innocent, I don't think we need to have a death penalty, because one thing you can't do is take back a death. Once you've executed that person, that's the end of it. and you can't undo it. I have absolute proof that if anybody would like to see it, I'll be more than happy to email them pictures of a criminal prosecution where the police who testified in court about pictures that they took, numbers are the pictures when they take them are sequentially numbered on the roll of film, where there were no bullets on a coffee table when they came in. They went in, they found the bullets, they put the bullets on the coffee table, took a picture. Of course, the picture with the bullets on the coffee table is what was shown to the jury. The cop perjured himself in the trial, and again, I can absolutely prove this. I have the pictures. The last thing in the world they thought is that I would get them, but I did. Which, the reason why I'm mentioning this is it shows that we do not have perfect prosecutions up here. If we don't want to have perfect prosecutions and we want to have the death penalty, then I think along with that we should make the prosecutors accountable, take away their immunity, and if it's found that someone was innocent who was put to death through the death penalty, then I think that prosecutor should be held accountable and that he should be charged with intentional murder, because he definitely intended to go after the death penalty and didn't care whether if his prosecution was perfect or not. And I realize that there is no such thing as perfect, but when you have perjured testimony from cops, you have people withholding evidence, and all the numerous problems that we just don't have time to go into with this criminal justice system,
Deborah,
up here,
Deborah, can you
I don't think we should have the death penalty.
Thank you. Can you begin to summarize your testimony for us, please?
Yes. Until you have perfect prosecutions, you should not have a perfect death penalty. You cannot undo a death.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Ms. Bloom? Ms. Bloom, I don't see any questions here at the judiciary table. Thank you very much for your remarks. We're going to hear from Don Roberts, and then after that we're going to go to John Novak with the Department of Law and open up the bill and the room to Mr. Novak to explain to us any nuances within this bill. And then, as I say, at 2:45, we're going to take up House Bill 101. So I will allow people that are waiting online to testify to be mindful that it's unlikely that we'll get to anybody after Mr. Roberts. Mr. Roberts from Kodiak, are you with us?
Yes, I am. My name is Don Roberts. I've lived in Alaska since May of 97. I speak against this. It's simply wrong. And I think the arguments to whether to make it fast or cheap or expensive or making it racially fair by executing more white people are just side issues, which don't make sense to me. It is simply wrong. And you can throw more money at it, you can streamline it, you can make it more fair in any way you want to, but it is simply wrong at the end. It's just, when I look at this and I see the sponsor statement speaking of justice, and I can't help but wonder if that's really a cup that you'd want to drink from at the same time. I see too much in our state that is unjust and wrong, and people just in positions that they shouldn't be. But getting back to this, I don't think you can make it fair. I don't think you can make it right to do this, and by covering all these bases. At the end, just to take that life is simply a wrong thing to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roberts. Are there questions? Representative Gatto has a question for you, Mr. Roberts.
Yes.
Mr. Roberts, you used the word wrong, I don't know how many, several times. Do you believe it is equally wrong to kill an innocent person as it is to execute a guilty person?
Could you say that one more time, sir?
Is it equally wrong to kill an innocent person as it is to execute a guilty person? Is it equal?
Is it equal? I have to say, equally wrong to kill an innocent person I don't.
It's okay.
I don't have a simple answer to that. I do know if I were in a situation where a family member were raped or murdered, I would want vengeance. But we're talking about justice and something else. If we were to kill an innocent person, that would be on our conscience. But that, again, to me, is still a side issue. I simply think it is wrong to kill a human being.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roberts. We appreciate your testimony today. It's an issue that we all struggle with. This is an issue with a lot of sharp edges. Thank you. We'd like to go to Mr. Novak, please, with the Department of Law. He's online. I'll remind members that Sue McClain is here, but I don't know that we have any questions for her at this point. Mr. Novak, are you with us?
He might know that he's not.
Oh, I see. Mr. Novak, you're muted if you're with us.
I'm here now, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Novak. We know that you were in trial when we tried to get with you the first few times, then we simply ran out of time, and Ms. McClain did an excellent job of standing in for you. We're grateful to have your insight into this very complex issue that triggers so much sentiment. The floor is yours, and then we will open it to questions for members. We have about 10 minutes on the subject, 10 or 15 minutes, and then we're going to put House Bill 9 aside for the day. We will not get to any more public testimony today for those that are online with apologies. We know it's fatiguing. Representative Coghill?
No, after his testimony.
Okay. Mr. Novak, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Member of the committee, it's my honor to be here today. I wish I could be there in person. I know Acting Attorney General Rick Sabatini wanted me to be there. Last week I completed on Thursday my most recent first-degree murder case, and so I couldn't be there last week. And unfortunately this week I'm actually on leave. I am the event chair for the National Nordic Ski Jumping, and so I've got people throughout the United States here on site in Anchorage, and we're hosting that. And so, but be that all as it may, I think this is a very important issue, a very important bill. And my goal really is to address a single point today. There's been quite a bit of discussion that I've heard about the idea that life without the possibility of parole is an adequate sentence to protect the citizens of our state. And that's simply not the case. I've been a prosecutor here representing the people for about 18 years now. And I want to talk about cases that I've handled, I've been involved with firsthand here in Alaska to demonstrate that the idea that innocent people are still killed by people who are serving life sentences. And I want to talk about a case, and I'm probably going to run out of time to talk about multiple cases. But there's two gentlemen by the name of Raymond Sheely and Douglas Gustafson. In 1990, the two of them were in a car, and they were driving from Eagle River to Anchorage. There was a third gentleman in the back seat by the name of George Kerr. Mr. Sheely was driving. Mr. Gustafson was a passenger. Mr. Gustafson had a semi-automatic rifle in his possession in the car. And another motorist kind of cut him off in traffic, and these two got enraged over that. And Mr. Sheely agreed to position the car, and Mr. Gustafson then shot another motorist and killed him. They went to trial. Both of them went to trial. They were separate trials. Mr. Gustafson went first, and he was convicted in front of Judge Johnstone. The second trial was for Mr. Sheely, and he was before Judge Milton Souter. Both of them were convicted. Both of them received sentences of in excess of 60 years for both of them. They were serving their sentences in our only maximum security prison here in Alaska, Spring Creek. It's So they are in our most secure prison here in Alaska, serving the equivalent of life sentences, not quite, but 60 and 65-year sentences. While in jail, Mr. Gustafson's brother and sister came and visited them. And the two of them, Mr. Sheely and Mr. Gustafson, together with the brother and sister, plotted about killing Mr. Kerr, because Mr. Kerr went to the police following the shooting, and he actually cooperated with the police and said, hey, I was in this car, and these two folks killed this person. And he actually got a wire warrant or a warrant to record conversations where the two of them made admissions. Mr. Kerr testified at trial. And so while these two then are serving their essentially life sentences, they plot to kill Mr. Kerr. And they talked with Mr. Gustafson's brother, and they taught him how to make this bomb. And they talked with Mr. Gustafson's sister, and she agreed to deliver the bomb. So while they're in our maximum security prison, the bomb is made. It's delivered by Mr. Gustafson's sister. And George Kerr, the intended target of this bomb, he's out of state. And his mom and his dad are home. And they packaged this bomb, making it appear like it was coming from the state of Alaska. And so mom and dad, who lived just outside of Anchorage at Thunderbird Falls area, they eventually start to think, hey, look, this package, it might be important. And so we probably ought to open it up, and then we'll let our son know what it is, because it appears to be from the state of Alaska. So they're at their kitchen table, and mom and dad are both in the kitchen, and dad opens up the package. Mr. Kerr Sr. is killed by this bomb, and mom is horribly maimed. And they reached out and touched and killed a person and maimed another while they're serving jail time. While this investigation is done then into this bombing, they come across a to-do list authored by these two guys, and the next person that they're going to plan to kill is Milton Souter, the trial judge. And the third person on the list who they're going to kill is the prosecutor, Stephen Branchflower. That case went to trial in federal court, and they were convicted of that killing as well. And so there's been a lot of testimony, principally from people of faith, the idea that we have this alternative that, you know, if we lock somebody up and we take away the possibility of parole, then we're protected. And this is a real live example of a case here in Alaska where it's not. Is the death penalty going to deter Mr. Sheely and Mr. Gustafson from killing again? You bet, because they can't kill again if they're dead. I can talk about a number of additional cases. There's another case by the name of Tim Donnelly and Peter Schwinn, a case that I handled. And basically their first murder was Mr. Donnelly, well, to shorten up the facts, it was a drug deal or purported drug deal, and their mark, they basically ripped him off. And Mr. Donnelly shot Mr. Cook, the victim, in the head, while Mr. Schwinn slit his throat. And Mr. Donnelly was convicted. We actually ended up trying it or prosecuting it in the federal system. And while Mr. Donnelly was serving his sentence in South Carolina, a federal prison there, he murdered his cellmate. And so once again, he was basically doing a life term in that federal court or federal prison, and yet he continued to kill. A third quick example is one that's recently been here in Alaska. It's a case out of Kenai by the name of Carl Abuel. And Mr. Abuel, he murdered somebody down in Ketchikan. And he received a 60-year sentence. He's serving his sentence at Spring Creek once again, and he decides that he wants to kill his cellmate. And he, in fact, does kill his cellmate. In this case, it was Gregory Bodine. And he wanted to kill this cellmate because he had this grandiose idea that Mr. Bodine was was this evil person, and he wanted to kill him. And during the course of that investigation as well, he confessed to murdering multiple additional people. And he said during the course of the investigation as well that he wanted to die. He wanted to be executed. And here in Alaska, we don't have that possibility. And so, I mean, like I say, there's, you know, a lot of these folks come from out of state, and they come from New York, and they have these stories. You know, I've had the honor of representing the people here in Alaska for 18 years, and there's real live cases here to demonstrate people, while they're serving sentences, continue to kill. Is there a way to protect the innocent people in our community short of capital punishment? I submit that there isn't. I don't think there's going to be a lot of cases where there's going to be seeking the death penalty. But in my experience, are there some cases? You bet. I have yet to speak with somebody when I talk to them about Mr. Gustafson and Mr. Sheely, not to recognize that, the appropriateness of the death penalty in that case. Most recently, when I was in Anchorage last week, and I talked to some of my colleagues who testified against it, and we were waiting there, and they said, "Are you in favor of this bill?" And I go, "You bet." And I talked about Sheely and Gustafson, and they even recognized it, I think. And so the idea here is this a perfect bill? You know, it might be improved. But the idea here is this. Is there a less harsh alternative to the death penalty? And I don't see one in the case of Mr. Gustafson or Mr. Sheely.
We've got
totally innocent people that are killed by two people that are being housed in our most secure facility in Alaska.
Mr. Novak, it's 2:45. We're going to take two questions, one from Representative Holmes and then one from Representative Lynn, and then we're going to let you go back to enjoying your leave. And we're going to take up this bill again in the next 14 days or so.
Pardon me?
We'll just ask you to keep the questions and answers short because we want to get House Bill 101 before the committee today. And we have some members that have to leave at 3 o'clock. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple questions I was going to ask, but I'll limit it to basically one line of questioning, which is, Mr. Novak, are you advocating for House Bill 9?
My specific role here is to, what I've been asked to do on behalf of the Department of Law, is to point out the need for specific deterrence. And so I can't tell you on behalf of the administration whether they support this specific bill or not, but what I can tell you is based on my experience in the Department of Law. The Department of Law believes it's appropriate in certain cases, and so, I mean, I hate to not answer the question, but that's what I have to answer.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted that clarified because we'd been told before that the Department of Law did not take a position on House Bill 9, and I'm pretty sure I heard Mr. Novak in his statement say that he supported the bill, and I wanted it to be clear that where the department does or doesn't stand on this bill.
Ms. McClain, do you want to come before the committee to clarify just on that point? I don't want to go on a field trip.
Seconds. I believe that Vice Chair Dahlstrom was here last week. This question came up after many people had left the room.
Would you just reintroduce yourself, for the record, please?
I apologize. Sue McClain from the Department of Law, and through the chair, in response to Representative Holmes' question, the administration supports the death penalty in concept, but believes that the details with regard to what specific legislation they would support have yet to be worked out.
Thank you, Ms. McClain. Representative Lynn,
for Mr. Thank Novak. You. I appreciate your testimony, sir. Could these same murders have been carried out by the people incarcerated for 60 years, been accomplished during the usual lengthy period for death penalty appeals of maybe 10 to 15 years?
Certainly. I mean, there's often cases. Let me try to answer your question. Representative, in my experience, cases absent the death penalty commonly go on for years and years and years. Here in Anchorage, for example, it's common now for us not to even get to trial from the date of the murder until from the time we charge until the trial is commonly 3 years now. The appeals are, you know, I'm working on murder cases that are more than 25 years old. And so the idea that litigation on murder cases stops in non-capital cases, I would submit is just wrong. They go on and they go on and they go on. I commonly have to call victims in cases and say, years later, and I'll have this conversation, and I'll say, hi, this is John Novak, and I'll hear their heart stop, and they'll ask, what's up? And then I'll say, well, the Court of Appeals just issued this. And then I'll have to call them back 2 and 3 years after that about what the Alaska Supreme Court said. And then there's even situations where it's going to the United States Supreme Court where we've got additional years. And so that's my attempt to answer your question. I'm sorry if I didn't do a very good job.
And so, very quickly. So make sure I understand this. If there was or was not a death penalty, the same thing could, in fact, have happened. That's my understanding of what you said. And I thank you for your answer, sir.
No answer required. Thank you very much, Mr. Novak. Enjoy the rest of your holiday. We appreciate you hosting folks in Alaska and showing them our great state. With that, Amanda, if you would come forward, if members would turn to House Bill 101, please. Amanda, welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. You have become quite an accomplished staff member here in the building, and you compose yourself remarkably. We're very excited to have you. If you will introduce yourself for the record and take us through House Bill 101.
Thank you very much. My name is Amanda Mortensen, and I'm staff for Representative Coghill. And House Bill 101, there's actually a CS to it. I don't know if we want, if you'd like a little bit of explanation on.
Amanda, give me just one moment. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 101, version E.
So moved. We now have before us the CS for House Bill number 101. If you'll take us through that, you have about 10 minutes and the full attention of this committee.
Thank you. House Bill 101 exempts the full value of life insurance and annuities from being attached to by creditors in the case of liabilities. This bill would protect Alaskan families and their ability to plan for their future. For example, if Person A was to hit Person B with a car, Person B could sue for the assets of Person A. This bill would protect Person A's life insurance and annuity contracts so their family could still survive on their own. It does not prevent Person B from being able to garnish Person A's other assets in order to fulfill a settlement. It also protects the death benefit of a spouse or a dependent of the debtor in the case that that person is not yet deceased. Currently, retirement plans are protected under federal law. This bill would help in the following situation. If an employee was working for an employer who did not offer a retirement plan, they could use annuities as a way to plan for their future and provide their families with better financial security. With the uncertainty of the Social Security system, Alaskan families need to be able to legitimately plan for their future. This bill falls under Title IX, the Code of Civil Procedure, and Chapter 38, which is the Alaska Exemptions Act. It then falls under Section 25, the Unmatured Life Insurance and Annuity section. Section 1 removes the $10,000 exemption cap on life insurance and annuities. Section 2 removes the words "or payable" in order to clarify a potential ambiguity regarding trying to garnish a death benefit on an individual that has not passed away yet. As of May 2007, 10 other states exempt life insurance and annuities 100% from creditors. And the CS removes the words "unmatured" in the title in order to, or sorry, not unmatured, unsecured, in order to make it a broader term to include other circumstances in which exemptions would apply besides just unsecured debt. So the legal team decided that that was a better way to include all circumstances.
Questions? Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I heard an earlier version of the bill in Labor and Commerce, but I'm a little bit interested in digging down into the discussion between including all debt versus secured and unsecured. I'm assuming that that we're going to have, at some point, we're going to have some people from either the Department of Law or somewhere else who will come explain that to us.
Yes, for the record, Amanda released all the professionals that were going to testify on this bill because we assumed that...
Mr. Chairman, I'm very patient.
more so than the chair. We will have experts here to offer testimony on that subject. Representative Gatto, did you have a question?
Just one. Did you use the word predator?
No, sir.
What was the word?
Predator?
Amanda?
Predator. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Sometimes it's the same.
Oh. Representative Lynn?
Creditor, predator, as is sometimes the same.
Duly noted. Representative Coghill, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
No, the question of the unsecured debt came up in the last committee, and we looked at it. There is going to be some professional testimony that will help us dig down into that. But I think this generally gives you a very clear description of the products that are going to be held exempt from garnishment. And I think we'll find that after public testimony that the scope is... even though broader from that language, still narrower based on statutory language. So I think we're going to find a good, reasonable answer to that. And the last time we had this up in a committee, that question came up. We didn't have a good answer for it, and I think we do now.
I'm looking forward to it.
Are there other questions before for the committee members? I'm fatigued from today's subject matter and some of the testimony that I thought didn't necessarily frame best thoughts of Alaskans living in the 21st century. I was a little bit challenged, and I'm not referring to Mr. Novak's professional testimony, but this is a House Bill 9 is a fatiguing subject, and Amanda, I thank you for bringing before us a very professional presentation, House Bill 101. And with that, at 5 minutes before 3, we're going to adjourn for the day and for the week. Thank you.